You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on September 12th, 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, we'll ask why Turkey is a reluctant ally in the fight against the Islamic State, what airstrikes in Syria might mean for Assad, and what's the latest in the Chinese president's anti-corruption drive, if indeed that's what it is. Joining me to give the answers to those questions and many more are my guests James Boyes and Raffaello Pantucci. Later in the show, we'll be talking to our correspondent in Greece, investigating the logistics of opening an art school in Pyongyang, and getting the thoughts of Ashanti Omkar on the latest Indian films, including this, Finding Fanny.
The first time I was kissed was on my wedding day, 15 minutes before my husband choked and died. I'm a virgin.
All that and more coming up right now on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24. A characteristically action-packed hour ahead, but before all that, Jonathan Wheatley has the world news.
The US Secretary of State John Kerry is in Turkey as he continues to canvass support for the campaign against Islamic State militants in Iraq as well as Syria. Kerry held talks with the Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. So far, 10 Arab countries have announced support for a broadened campaign against IS, and Israel says it fully supports the US strategy, with the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu saying the country is already playing a role, and he said the fight against the militants could develop stronger ties within the region.
I think it's crucial not to let the fight against Sunni extremism make us forget the danger of Shiite extremism. They're two sides of the same coin. We don't have to strengthen one to weaken the other. My policy is weaken both. And most importantly, don't allow any of them to get weapons of mass destruction.
Meanwhile, the French President François Hollande is in Baghdad to discuss humanitarian aid and military support for Iraq's fight against Islamic State insurgents. Jane Kinnamont is from the think tank Chatham House. She believes the group could have grown in recent months.
It will be seen by jihadis as having had successes. Taking a city as large as Mosul will make it stand out from the crowd of, you know, the fairly diverse and large variety of jihadi and other militant groups that are going around in Iraq and Syria. So I wouldn't be surprised at all. But I would note that the CIA has said that it could be between 20 and 31,000. So the margin of error here is pretty large.
President Vladimir Putin said on Friday that new Western sanctions against Russia looked a bit strange, given his backing of peace efforts in eastern Ukraine, and warned he was considering taking fresh retaliation. The European Union and the United States have tightened economic penalties on Moscow, accusing it of sending troops to back pro-Moscow separatists fighting Ukrainian government forces in eastern regions. The number of new Ebola cases in West Africa is growing faster than authorities can manage them, the World Health Organization said on Friday, renewing a call for health workers from around the world to go to the region to help. The WHO said the vast nature of the outbreak required a massive emergency response. Meanwhile, the wife of the third US missionary worker to be infected with Ebola while working in Liberia says he's making a good recovery. 51-year-old Dr. Rick Sacra had been flown back to America a few days ago for treatment in Nebraska. Well, Debbie Sacra said today that they are putting his recovery down to faith and science.
I know that he would hate all this attention, but if he can use it to make sure that resources are used well in Liberia and in Sierra Leone and Guinea to help lick this thing and build up the healthcare system so that they're not at risk of this kind of disaster again, that he will do everything he can from here on out to make sure that that's true.
And finally, state police in Maryland say a local man alleged to have cocaine on his face and clothes and to be driving while drunk was arrested after he told an officer he had holy water in his car and thought he was in Chicago. Artist Ray Gordon, who's 69 from Baltimore, was arrested after an accident and allegedly sitting in his Cadillac in the middle of the road blocking traffic. He was charged with possessing a drug other than marijuana, driving under the influence of alcohol, driving while impaired by alcohol, driving while so impaired that the vehicle could not be driven safely, failing to obey designated lane directions, driving while impaired by drugs, failing to control vehicle speed, and failing to obey traffic control devices. And that's the news on Monocle 24.
At which point, presumably, he shouted, "Bingo!" Thank you, Jonathan. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We will be back right after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. See on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House. It's 18:06 in London. That's 13:06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on today's news, I have in the studio two Monocle 24 regulars. James Boyes, author of Clinton's Grand Strategy, U.S. Foreign Policy in a Post-Cold War World, and wearer of many academic hats. And Raffaello Pantucci of Russi, and also author of We Love Death As You Love Life, Britain's Suburban Mujahideen. First of all, it's now 48 hours, give or take, since President Barack Obama sighed to the American people about a return to war in the Middle East. His Secretary of State John Kerry is continuing his tour of the region in order to enlist allies for a campaign against the Islamic State. Today, Kerry reached Turkey, where he is not, as might have been assumed, pushing at an open door. Ankara is thus far unkeen on the US Air Force flying combat missions off American bases in the south of the country. James, I'll ask you first, why are Turkey being weird about this?
Well, if you remember, there's a track record of this. If you go back 10 years, they were also being weird, to use your fantastic analytical perspective, in terms of letting the United States enter Iraq from their territory as a land bridge.
Indeed, that's true. But Turkey at the time were among those, and there were quite a few of them who thought that the invasion of Iraq was a calamitously idiotic idea, whereas there does seem to be a global consensus that sorting out the Islamic State is something that needs to be done.
Yeah, it seems that Turkey kind of want it always, don't they? On the one hand, when it suits their European power, they want, when they want to come into the EU, NATO, and they can be an Asian power when it doesn't suit. So it's a difficult beast to deal with. I think John Kerry is really going to have his work cut out for him in his ongoing bid for a Nobel Peace Prize. He's out there trying, desperately seeking that at all times. I think if you look at some of the other lists on that list, it's interesting to see that that Qatar is on there, of course, because in recent months there's been speculation that Qatar have indeed been aiding ISIS. So the idea that they've come out now and added their name to the list is very interesting.
Qatar,
I think,
have indeed signed the Jeddah communique, yeah, which we will come to shortly. Raffaello, are Turkey playing hard to get here? Is there something they want?
I think it's a combination of things. I think on the one hand, there is a sense of concern in Turkey that if they throw their lot in so clearly with a group that's attacking this group ISIS, with the coalition of nations that's attacking this group ISIS, this could have repercussions. And if you're going to look at ISIS striking outside, it's more likely to strike regionally than it is to go anywhere further. So I think the Turks have got a good cause to worry. If we look at how people are getting into Syria and Iraq, they're flowing through Turkey. Now, the Turks were aiding and abetting that for some time, and this was in part because they were struck in this sort of struggle against the Syrians. The problem is that now the trouble has split to Iraq and we've got this beast in ISIS that's developed. It's a much more difficult picture for them because on the one hand, this is something that they kind of support because they're anti-Assad. But on the other hand, they're very worried about it, you know, fighting against it too much. And they've watched it expand and, you know, continue to use their territory. And even, you know, there's been some incidents within sort of Turkish territory that, like down in Reyhanli, there was at least one bombing, which may or may not have been connected to someone connected to ISIS. You know, so they have got a very potential and very real risk of backlash from the battlefield, which ultimately is right next door to them.
James, you mentioned there the Jeddah communique, which is doubtless being appropriated as the name for some ghastly indie group in Dalston as we speak. Ten Arab nations have signed it, promising, and I quote, to do their share in the comprehensive fight against the Islamic State. Now, in practice, what's that going to mean?
It's difficult to tell at this point, to be honest, because what you can glean from Barack Obama's speech the other night is that what the US wants to do is to basically sanitize the air. It wants to create an envelope. What it doesn't want to do is the heavy fighting. It wants to come in, clear the airspace, and allow regional powers to do the fighting. As Rafael Wright pointed out, if there's going to be any blowback, it's going to be in the region. Nobody is necessarily expecting anything to manipulate upon the wider sphere. So what the Americans want is to basically get the locals to do the fighting for them. By pledging to do their bit, you know, let's be honest, that's very, very vague.
Indeed.
But it shouldn't be beyond the realm of possibility for the Americans to expect the local nations to stand up and defend their own interests against this organization, which clearly has great threat to many nations in that part of the world.
The latest estimate from the CIA now estimates that the Islamic State has 31,000 fighters under their command, which is about triple what they'd previously estimated. James, you mentioned there, or you invoked the idea of heavy fighting that somebody was going to have to go and do. Air power alone is not going to shift them, is it?
Correct. I mean,
the United States has made 154 airstrikes already, can carry on bombing them, presumably with impunity, because at the risk of tempting fate, they have no surface-to-air capacity at all. Rafaelo,
they do have some. They have managed to shoot some stuff down, yeah. I mean, whether they can shoot down this sort of
thought.
It is quite a worrying thought, and you're 100% right. But I mean, the issue is that I don't know if they have the capacity to shoot down sort of American jets who fly at very high altitudes and can hit things from very far away. But, you know, they have managed to get their hands on some pretty heavy hardware and some that has brought down planes. If we look in Syria, we can see that there have been a number of instances of Syrian aircraft being shot down.
But nonetheless, somebody is going to have to go in on the ground.
Yeah, I think your fundamental point is that, you know, airstrikes alone aren't going to resolve this problem. And that's true. I think the issue is that I would be very surprised if we're going to see American or Western forces going in and forced to do that. I think, unfortunately, the real push is that the US will continue to provide close air support for Kurdish and other forces on the ground and try to be the people who actually unseat the group. But I think fundamentally, the real longer term solution to this problem is going to be ultimately a regional one. So getting regional actors, like all the ones who've signed this declaration, on board is important. But, you know, actually mobilizing people on the ground to counter the group is the real issue. And actually, within Iraq, we could look at history and see that it's happened a bit before. There was the Awakening Movement back in, I think it was 08, 09, when we saw that the Sunni tribes in Anbar province basically rejected ISIS's precursor group, ISI, and rose up against it. And that was kind of the foundation of the group's sort of a shrinkage for some period. The problem is really in Syria, where who is the other actor you can empower on the ground to counter this? So even if we say that we can resolve the situation in Iraq, or at least draw it down back to some sort of manageable scale, what's going to happen in Syria, where you've got a very bloody civil war continuing to go on, and where, you know, who is the actor who you would try to support? Is it a case of supporting the Assad regime? I mean, that would be a huge negative sort of shift if any Western government start going in that direction.
James, just finally on this particular subject, how does the United States break that cycle and avoid ending up in the position again where it tries to sort out the Middle East while everybody else in the Middle East complains that America's trying to sort out the Middle East?
Ah, the easy question.
Indeed.
You're a student of American geopolitics.
Right for writing a book about it.
I'm going to say, it's all my fault. I don't know if it does, quite frankly. I think the only thing that might save it is the fact that this administration's time is ticking down. In just over 2 years and a little over a month, this administration will have its time up completely, and we'll know whether there's going to be a first woman in the White House effectively or not. This is one of the great issues. There is such a continuing timescale within Washington that basically prevents long-term thinking. One of the challenges you've got in terms of going into that region, of course, now is we have Russia, for example, talking about, you know, don't get involved in Syria. The only good thing about all this, I think, is at least now we're not talking about what I used to refer to as a pale coalition of NATO. We do now have a series of Arab nations, effectively, who are getting behind this. So, you know, Obama's coalition is a lot less pale, I think, than George Bush's coalition of the willing, which can only be a good thing at this point.
Well, let's focus now on Syria specifically. President Obama obviously made it clear in his address on Wednesday night that the US will strike at Islamic State targets inside Syria. Rafaelo, Syria is claiming that it needs to to grant permission before, and, you know, you can only wish them good luck with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But is there any way that the United States bombing Islamic State targets inside Syria won't work for President Assad?
No, I think it's clearly ultimately going to play, it's to his advantage. It's eliminating one of his allies, or enemies, I'm sorry. he needs more allies. But it does have that effect. But I think the problem is that there's kind of no other way to this, there's no other solution to this, because as we've seen in this group ISIS, it's one that really crosses both borders. And if you're really going to address the group, then you're going to have to do it in both places. You look at the city of Raqqa, which is where they've sort of set up their headquarters in Syria, and very much the capital of this sort of Islamic emirate that they state that they've created. It sits in the middle of Syria. And so it's going to have to be a case of American forces going in there through air power. And in fact, we know that they've already tried to go in there in special forces to try to rescue some of the hostages. There was a report that emerged that American special forces team had gone in fact, to, I think, somewhere around Raqqa to try to rescue James Foley and some of the other Americans who were being held. Unfortunately, they weren't actually there when they got in. But this shows that there is already some movement by the United States going into Syria. This does certainly play to President Assad's advantage. The question becomes, you know, is this a case of maybe also strengthening some of the other rebel factions that are fighting in Syria, who at the moment are very engaged in fighting against ISIS as well? If they don't have the group ISIS to fight against, could it be that they then turn their guns to a greater degree against the Assad regime? So, you know, it could kind of play both ways.
James, having written a book about American foreign policy, you will be more aware than most that for America more than most countries, conducting a non-hypocritical foreign policy is probably completely impossible. Nevertheless, how do they avoid either the appearance or indeed the actuality that, you know, after 2 or 3 years of demonizing Bashar al-Assad, not without reason, as one of the worst human beings in the world, etc., they effectively end up acting as his air force?
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? Let me answer that question by coming back to your first question, which was, why are Turkey playing so interesting a game here? You know, if you are looking for leadership in this day and age, is Barack Obama the guy you want to put your money on? 2 weeks ago, there was no strategy at all.
He admitted as much himself.
Absolutely.
In an appropriately beige suit.
Absolutely. and now all of a sudden, hey, guess what? We've got a 5-point plan and we're going to do this, that and the other, and America's fantastic. You know, you wouldn't want to get behind these guys and guarantee that they've got your backs, I don't think, quite frankly. There is a great problem here. There is no grand strategy, I don't think, in this part of the world. Obama's based his entire presidency upon withdrawing from hotspots in the world. Now, at the last hour almost of his presidency, he's going into this area, but on a very limited basis. I think he's doing the absolute minimum possible. He doesn't want to commit ground troops because he doesn't want to get drawn into a ground war there. He doesn't want to be seen to be doing nothing because that will be an absolute anathema to his liberal base, effectively. So he's doing just about enough, effectively. He's saying, I'll give you air cover, we'll defy the Syrian border, effectively, but we don't want to get too heavily involved and annoy, let's put it this way, annoy the Russians too much. But neither do I want American casualties on my watch. So there is, as you say quite correctly, an absolute hypocrisy to this. Guess what? That's standard policy.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, this whole question of hypocrisy and double standards in foreign policy is something that's often talked about. To me, it feels too simplistic an explanation. I think the reality is the world's a very complicated place. And I think when we're looking at the war in Syria, you're dealing with this sort of very thorny situation of having both sides that you don't really support. And at the same time, you can't just continue to let this bite struggle on, you know, in this sort of horrible way, because all it's doing is sucking in other problems and expanding instability around the region. So the question becomes, you have a bad set of choices. How do you kind of make some out of it? I would agree with you that the United States has been somewhat lacking in terms of leadership in foreign policy more generally for, I would argue, most of the past few years. But at the same time, I do think that to put it down to hypocrisy and double standards kind of oversimplifies something which is frankly just very complicated.
On the subject of hypocrisy and double standards, we do have to move along, but we should not leave this subject without noting on that subject that Russia has said that US strikes in Syria would be a crude violation of international law.
And you know they never violate international territory, do they?
We should ask Ukraine about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I, for one, am really happy to hear lectures from Russia on that subject at the moment. We will take a short break right now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Miller, along with James Boyes and Raffaello Pantucci. When we return, we'll be discussing a proposed constitutional referendum in a country whose parliament has recently been forced to operate offshore. And we'll learn more about counter-corruption, if indeed that's what it is, in China.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight. From New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delorme.
From Monaco.
From Monaco.
In Tel Aviv.
From Monaco.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
From Monaco. I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So, whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are James Boyes and Raffaello Pantucci. And completing tonight's trifecta of Middle Eastern foreign policy headaches, we will look now at Libya. The judgment of when a given country becomes a failed state is not an exact science, but it's fair to say that the moment your elected parliament is forced to seek refuge in a commandeered Greek car ferry is the moment at which you have to be considered for the title. Correspondence to Libya's alleged rulers should now be addressed to the 17,000-ton Eleiros, somewhere off Tobruk. Raffaello, obviously, this isn't funny. This is an extremely serious situation. But really, if you're governing from a car ferry somewhere off the coast of the third biggest city in your country because you can't actually set foot in the other two, are you still governing?
It's a very good question. And I think Libya is an issue which in some ways has kind of slipped from the public agenda since the death of Muammar Gaddafi. But it's only gotten worse, frankly, since then. And we've seen basically in the east of the country, you've got groups like Ansar al-Sharia that have essentially declared that they're creating a sort of proxy emirate themselves. And it's essentially ungoverned space. If we look back to the attack in early 2013 against the gas plant in In Amenas, that was essentially out of training camps in southern Libya. So we've had a number of incidents like this. And there's no particular evidence that any government sitting in Tripoli has been able to control any of the country beyond, frankly, Tripoli. So I think that we have a real catastrophe on our hands there that, frankly, is just sort of happening in slow motion. I think the fact that they've decided now to hold a constitutional vote in December is a pretty extraordinary declaration of optimism, frankly, which I wish was going to come more true than it would. But it's very difficult to see sort of where the good choices are. I mean, we've got most Western powers, I think, have withdrawn their embassies from Tripoli at the moment as well.
Indeed they have. The UN have sent a new special envoy, Bernardino Leon, who arrived yesterday, and one can only wish him well with that. James, Raffaello mentioned this constitutional referendum they are hoping to hold in December. In fairness to Libya, they did have what was by all accounts a relatively well-organised general election in June, even if the previous parliament has refused to recognise the result of it, which is why we now have, well, we have at once two governments and no government. Is this referendum in December actually, is it imaginable that this is going to fix anything?
It's doubtful. It would be lovely to think it could. I don't think anyone's expecting Jeffersonian democracy to break out anytime soon in that part of the world. It's tragic, isn't it? You know, we laugh about it, but, you know, only a few short years ago, we were talking about the Arab Spring, the suggestion that maybe somewhere in Texas, someone was smiling at the idea that democracy was being spread from Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, etc., etc. Now everything's very much in a retrenched state. How the United States must be woeing the day, effectively, that this all took place. I think, you know, as we were talking a minute or two ago, this has slipped from the agenda, but I don't think Libya's going anywhere anytime soon. You know, from my own perspective, you know, we're going to be seeing a lot more talk about Libya, not only because of the fiasco of a government governing by ship, effectively, but of course, as we move into the 2016 presidential cycle, I can assure you that the word Benghazi is going to be mentioned many, many times because
Indeed.
Of the event there. You know, the idea that mere anarchy has been loosed upon the land. You know, it's all very well to overthrow these iron strong men, effectively, like Gaddafi, but time and time again, we see that they have held those countries together, albeit with an iron fist. And,
this is the depressing bargain all those awful old bastards who ran the Middle East used to make, that I may be bad, but what I'm holding back is worse. And I mean, it's a deeply depressing observation to have to make, but they might have been right. I mean, how have we ended up in a situation where Libya is now worse than it was under the ghastly rule of Colonel Gaddafi?
Well, I mean, I think certainly as an exporter of instability, yes, we can say that Libya now is exporting a lot more trouble regionally than it was previously. Though, you know, it's worth pointing out that if we look back at the foreign fighters who were going to Iraq during the 2003 onwards American operation there, or invasion there, there was a lot of Libyans going there, and there was a lot of people from Derna and Benghazi and Misrata who were going out and fighting there, and they in fact formed some of the most important cadres who were leading this fight against the Americans. So I think it's always been a country that's been problematic. I think this whole dilemma of, you know, is it better to have these sort of strong men rule these countries and sort of keep these various, you know, restive tribes at bay, I mean, in some ways it's not actually really solving the problem. All you're doing is postponing the sort of inevitable. At some point the leader will fall and chaos will ensue. So, you know, the question becomes, what do you just constantly replace it with a new strong leader and he will sort of manage it slowly out? I mean, I don't know if we've had much evidence of sort of strong leaders in this part of the world slowly moving their countries towards democracy, though that's what they all say they're going to do.
What was fascinating about Libya, though, was that you saw a shift in Gaddafi. I mean, from the 1980s, where he was Mad Dog effectively and almost America's enemy number one, you know, who were the bad guys in Back to the Future?
On the subject of hypocrisy in foreign policy.
Absolutely, but don't forget there was a shift in Gaddafi. You know, the idea, I think he saw what happened in Iraq and realised, I can see the writing on the wall, effectively. You know, the deal with Tony Blair, the idea of surrendering a WMD capacity, effectively. There was a shift in his behaviour. Now, whether it was too little too late is open to debate, effectively. But I think there was a marked movement with regard to his behaviour. And maybe he was becoming someone who, in the words of Margaret Thatcher, we could have famously done business with prior to his untimely demise, perhaps.
Well, let's look finally at China, where the high-profile anti-corruption drive initiated by President Xi Jinping looks set to claim another big-wigged scalp, that of Zhao Yongkang, the former overlord of the country's security services. He's being investigated over potential or alleged involvement in the car crash which killed his ex-wife Wang Shuhua in 2000. Raffaello, we've talked a lot on Monocle 24 with you about the anti-corruption drive in China. Mm. We always end up asking the same question, so I'll ask it again. Is this a genuine anti-corruption probe, or is this Xi whacking another rival?
No, I think that the taking down Zhou Yongkang is really a very important story. I mean, this is the most senior person within the party that we've seen brought down since the Gang of Four in the sort of, when was it, 1960s, I think it was. I might be getting that date slightly wrong. So it's a very significant thing. This is a guy who is really at the top of the party, and there was a perception that once you got to this level, you were essentially untouchable, even though the levels of corruption at this level of the party are speculated to be wildly, wildly high. I think the question of whether this anti-corruption drive is genuine, you know, it's been going on for a very long time now. You know, this is basically since Xi Jinping has been in power. And we're talking now, like a good year and a bit now, you know. So we're talking about a long period of time that this is going on. In fact, so much so that there's beginning to be a question of if it's starting to have a negative effect and if it's actually starting to freeze up the sort of capability of the Chinese system to govern.
But just persisting with that first question, it's not just Zhao. His eldest son, his wife and his brother are also all in the slammer awaiting charges, as along with more than 300 family, friends and associates. This is sounding a bit like a vendetta, isn't it?
Well, I mean, the thing is, when you're dealing with a very senior figure like that, he has very strong patronage networks. And so what you saw happen over the past year was these networks slowly getting chipped away. Now, cynics used to say that since so many of the high-level arrests were happening within this guy's circle, it was clearly just targeted at him. But in fact, if we look more broadly, the anti-corruption drive has brought down a lot of people who are sort of beyond his immediate patronage networks. He seems to be the highest profile figure they've gone after, though there's now a question of if they're going to be going after the former leader Jiang Zemin or Li Peng, whose family members have also been implicated in some of the cases that we're seeing. But, you know, in a way, it sort of makes sense, because if you've got corruption investigators who are looking at a case, that case will unravel other individuals. And so you sort of end up following these people in a kind of spider pattern. So it would make sense that you would end up taking down one kind of network as a first thing. But I do think that there is a general chilling that we've seen going through the system, and that people across the Chinese system do feel as though they are potentially under risk of investigation. We've seen, you know, lots of other anecdotal evidence of this. For example, in sales of luxury products in China has plummeted, you know, and traditionally that was how, you know, people could sort of pay off someone they were buy them a nice watch. We've seen sales of these things drop. We've seen what red wine, I think, French wine used to go in gallons over to into China. That's decreased substantially as well. So there are lots of other indicators that show that this anti-corruption drive does maybe seem to be broader than just a direct vendetta against Zhou Yongkang.
James, what do you think? Is this just palace intrigue, or rather Forbidden City intrigue, or is China actually changing fundamentally how it works?
It's maybe a little early to tell. I think there's an old saying, isn't there? There's two things you don't want to ever get seen being made, and that's laws and sausage. And maybe we could add to that list, what we don't want to see is investigation of the security services, because there's one thing you don't want is this person's taking the stand and spilling all. We've seen some very high-profile cases.
He may know literally as well as metaphorically
where the bodies are buried. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. We've seen that before, and what tends to happen is these people, they talk about having a trial, and then it never, ever happens. I'm reminded of Pinochet, for example. You know, there was no way the CIA was ever going to let that trial take place, I don't think. So whether this will ever go forward, whether there'll be another accident, for example, whether we'll just disappear, who knows. But certainly a lot of intrigue coming out of Beijing.
Gentlemen, we will have to leave it there. We have reached the bottom of the hour. James Boyes and Raffaello Pantucci, thank you very much as ever for joining us here at Midori House. You're listening to Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
런던으로부터 모노클 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monaco 24.
位于 伦敦, 这是 Monaco 24.
Outlondo, tu vai Monaco 24.
Fra London, dette Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monaco 24.
And there's loads still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll have film tips from Ashanti Omkar, and we'll learn about plans for an art academy in a somewhat surprising location. But before we get started on all that, Jonathan Wheatley has the headlines.
Thank you very much. The US Secretary of State John Kerry is in Turkey's capital, Ankara, as he continues to canvass support for the campaign against Islamic State militants in Iraq as well as Syria. So far, 10 Arab nations have announced support for that broadened US campaign against IS. Meanwhile, the French President François Hollande is in Baghdad to discuss humanitarian aid and also military support for Iraq's fight against Islamic State insurgents. President Vladimir Putin said on Friday that new Western sanctions against Russia looked a bit strange, given his backing for peace efforts in eastern Ukraine, and he warned he was considering taking fresh retaliation. And the number of new Ebola cases in West Africa is growing faster than authorities can manage them, the World Health Organization said today, renewing a call for health workers from around the world to go to the region to help. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Jonathan. Welcome back to Midori House, live on Monocle 24. It's 21:32, or will be very shortly in Moscow, 18:32 in London, 14:32 in Rio. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today we're heading to Greece, where Natalie Savarikas is ready to give us the latest there. Natalie, welcome to the show. First day of school, back to school in Greece yesterday, but a bit quiet for a lot of the students.
Yes, especially for the students who don't live in the big cities. Essentially, what's happening is many teachers' posts are left vacant, and that's because the government in the past few years has desperately tried to implement Troika-demanded cuts. That's the cuts that are demanded by the country's lenders, which means that there are just around 9,000 posts, and that's according to union officials, that have been left vacant. Now, the ministry themselves say the number is far smaller, in the several hundreds, but it means that many kids might be happy that they will not have any lessons. But of course, let's see for how long this lasts, because the results could be pretty worrying.
Natalie, we talked a lot during the worst of the euro crisis about how the cuts, those imposed by the Troika, were affecting Greece. And obviously, what with one thing and another, Greece has kind of dropped off the news radar the last couple of years or so. And I think people have probably assumed, well, everything must be fine. Does Greece still feel like it is in a period of great struggle? Does it feel like the crisis is continuing?
Well, it really does depend to whom, you know, you talk to. I think what's happening in Greece, essentially, is that most people are used to the crisis. They figured out the mechanisms to make ends meet, if you will. So essentially, many people who don't have electricity have figured out ways to reconnect the electricity. And I was just talking actually to a lawyer not long ago who handled many cases of Greeks who've been stealing the electricity from the authorities and actually have been acquitted for their crimes because they're just desperate to have it. Also, family ties very much have helped Greeks survive all these struggles. And this very high and skyrocketing unemployment that's still very much present. So I think it's more a sense that Greeks just have learned the tricks and are struggling to survive and waiting for the numbers. The Prime Minister has pledged that the country is about to return to growth. So they're really waiting to see how this will translate on the ground and whether this will mean that foreign investment might help the country just turn around and, you know, get back on its feet.
Well, adding to those employment and unemployment numbers were an awful lot of former employees of Greece's state broadcaster who were dismissed as part of the austerity drive. The government is apparently going to have to find a way to pay them again.
Yes, indeed. I mean, we just had the Athens court that vindicated some 10 former employees of ERT, the state broadcaster. The court rejected their dismissals and ordered authorities to reinstate their jobs and salaries. Now, the big thing is that this could open the floodgates, allowing other employees to pursue the same legal procedure and launch proceedings against the state, claiming that they were unfairly dismissed. At the moment, though, it seems that the decision is not directly enforceable and the state is, however, allowed to appeal. It does remain to be seen how all this will continue, Andrew. And if I may, interestingly enough, just recently we found out that the chairman of the new state broadcaster and his deputy have resigned, accusing the government of not helping the broadcaster being biased and objective. So they've pretty strong accusations were thrown towards the authorities.
So what's the next step in this? Can the state appeal and will the state appeal? Because I can't imagine that there's a way that you can appeal against giving people their jobs back and come out of it looking good.
Well, I mean, amidst what, I mean, this, as I mentioned, this latest scandal that the hirings are made in a not very transparent way, I think they will directly appeal to try and save face in a way. But it does remain to be seen how this will happen. I think it will definitely go straight up to the Court of Appeal and perhaps after that to the Supreme Court. I think both sides will want to make their case heard.
Okay, well, finally, some good news, I guess, well, potentially good news. It's possible that a Greek film could get up to the gate at the Oscars.
Well, it won't be unlikely. I mean, Greece is not really well known for its big, you know, fantastic movies. But it has recently submitted yet another movie for nomination at the Oscars. It's a quite interesting movie. It's basically based on the story about two sisters in love with the same man. It's a movie that is quite a... you know, it's called the Little England by one of the country's biggest directors, Pantelis Voulgaris. It's premiered at the Shanghai Film Festival. I mean, the odds are in its favor, although, you know, it remains to be seen. And five Greek movies have already been nominated at the Oscars. Remains to be seen how this one will fare, but the Greeks are extremely excited over that because they really think that this one might actually have a shot.
And why is it entitled Little England?
Well, good question. Because, to be completely honest, I haven't actually spoken to the wife of the director who wrote the novel on which the film is based. But it's I really would not, to be honest, actually.
Well, I mean, it may attract some attention in this country for that reason, if for no other. But we wish them well with that. That's Little England by Pantelis Voulgaris, winner of the Best Film Award at the Hellenic Film Awards. Natalie Savarikas in Athens, thank you as ever for joining us. Up next, we'll be hearing about plans for an art school in possibly the last place you'd expect. Stay tuned to find out more. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
The menu isn't just about food or drinks, it's about the people with innovative ideas, the ones who savor traditions, and the ones who are willing to go further than most in search of the most delicious ingredients. Whether it's an author who's discovered true adventure through food, or a master bartender traveling the world in search of new and exciting flavors, the menu uncovers the tastiest tales from around the globe.
We are finally walking to the simple way of eating, being, but I think it's a universal trend, this kind of simplicity.
As well as going behind the scenes with top chefs such as René Redzepi and Massimo Bottura, we find out the latest in restaurant design, the creative culinary experiences keeping city dwellers' taste buds tingling, and what Japanese clubbing culture and noodles have in common. Join me, Markus Hipp, before the menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller. It's just coming up for 18:40 here in London. Now, North Korea's visual arts, at least as the rest of the world gets to see them, tend to be somewhat limited in concerns. Between fire-breathing declarations of hostility towards America and or South Korea, and cheery depictions of happy workers beaming at tractors, lathes, and other harbingers of the red dawn of socialism. A group of Norwegian artists hopes to expand that palette. They plan to open an art school in Pyongyang for a trial period next year and hopefully permanently beyond that. Joining me now is Morten Travik, one of the artists behind the project. Morten, art, at least as we in the West are privileged to understand it, is all about freedom of expression. Is art as we understand it even possible in a country where there isn't any?
Well, I guess this project, as many of the previous projects that I have directed and realized in and about North Korea and with the collaboration of North Korean artists before, I have been doing this for three years now, is challenging the assumptions about North Korea and challenging the assumption about the outside world in North Korea. And one of the most common assumptions is the one you just mentioned, that there is no freedom of expression in North Korea.
Isn't that the case?
No, it's certainly not. I mean, there are some freedoms of expression which certainly are limited, like political freedom of expression. You are, of course, not allowed to criticize in any way, form or shape the ruling regime or the ruling party. Having said that, I would say, just to mention an instance, that North Korean women have a far larger scope of freedom of expression than their sisters in, say, countries like Pakistan or Saudi Arabia, or countries that...
That's setting a fairly low bar, and at least their sisters in Pakistan are allowed to vote from time to time.
I wouldn't get too fixated on that one freedom when there are other freedoms that are open.
Indeed. When you are interacting with North Korean artists, what is their view of art and what it's for? I mean, do they deal exclusively in propaganda kits, or are there other avenues of expression available to them?
There certainly are. I mean, most art that is produced in North Korea is not about those two genres that you mentioned. Most art is certainly figurative. And certainly not contemporary in its way of thinking, the way as we know it. But the propaganda art is actually now becoming more and more of a relic, much like in China. Most people actually consuming propaganda art now are Western tourists or collectors abroad.
As you mentioned, you've worked on other projects in North Korea, including establishing a Norwegian festival in Pyongyang. You've travelled extensively in North Korea. How have you been able to build up the kind of relationship with officialdom in Pyongyang which has allowed you to do things like this?
Well, I guess one of the keywords is being able to go there more than once. Luckily, I live in a little oil sheikdom at the far northern end of Europe with a quite liberal culture policy and the money to back it up. So I have had the opportunity to actually be able to go back several times and to develop both projects and thereby also trust by interacting with North Korean artists and cultural authorities over time. So I think this is one of the main keys to that, to having that action space that we have now.
In establishing this project you're trying to do, the temporary art school in Pyongyang next summer, hopefully the permanent one beyond that. How do you avoid, and I guess, because I know you want to bring other foreign artists along as well, how do you reassure them that they, and indeed yourself, that you are not being compromised by an association with a regime which is, you know, really pretty ghastly?
Well, I guess if you see it from that angle, we are already compromised. If your line of view is that the regime indeed is one of the most ghastly in the world, then I guess we are already compromised by dealing with it at all, aren't we?
But when this school actually gets up and running, especially next summer, what do you envisage taking place there? What are you hoping it will accomplish, both for the North Korean artists and for the foreign artists you bring in?
Well, what I hope and do believe it will accomplish is no more or no less than providing a meeting space, a DMZ, as we have called the DMZ Academy, demilitarized zone, where visiting artists will be able to produce and also to demonstrate their ways of working, their ways of thinking about art, and the Korean artists will be able to do the same. And then whether that will be a fusion or a fission, we don't know yet. But that's part of the attraction, I guess.
Do you have any sense of how tightly that exchange will be policed by the authorities? Because as you were saying earlier, there are some freedoms of expression which are absolutely not permissible in North Korea. And obviously in the West, art is very frequently used and seen as a vehicle for subversion, for rebellion, for protest. How closely will you be watched?
Well, it's basically me who will be policing that exhibition. This is one of the basic premises that I have agreed with the North Koreans, that of course I am the middleman here, and I have worked enough in North Korea to have a sense of what battles it makes sense to take and what it makes sense to leave alone. But I have to underline that one of the main ambitions, of course, is to widen the perspectives. But if we widen the perspectives, we need to be able to do it in both directions. So this is not a kind of a crusade for opening up North Korea. This is more just providing a platform, which might or might not lead to some, North Korean artists changing their mentality and, you know, going to join Banksy in London at a later point.
When you have spoken to North Korean artists on previous visits, though, what is their understanding of what Western art is like? Do they have any feel for it at all, or does it just seem as weird and strange to them as socialist realist pictures do to us?
Well, I mean, they know who Picasso was, but it kind of stops there. You know, what they learn after Picasso, Western artist, seen from a socialist realist point of view, really, you know, went downhill. So this is basically where their art history education stops. But then again, I mean, most so-called Western art isn't really that subversive. is it?
True enough. Certainly in these postmodern times, very true enough. Morten Travik from the DMZ Academy opening in Pyongyang next summer. Thank you very much for joining us. It's time now for some music. And one of our previous guests' previous visits to North Korea was responsible for bequeathing the world this gem. It's the masked accordionists of North Korea's Kumsong School with their version of the Norwegian pop classic A-ha's Take On Me. The accordionists of North Korea's Kumsong School with their version of A-ha's Take On Me. You're listening to The Daily on... You're not listening to The Daily. You will be later on from 2200 hours listening to The Daily if you have any sense. Right now you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's that time in the show, towards the end of it, clearly when I start thinking about the next show, when we review the best, occasionally the worst, of what is occurring in television, books, theatre, etc. Today it's the turn of cinema and I'm joined once again by Ashanti Omkar, who has been watching movies for us, so we don't have to again. You wanted to start with a film called Finding Fanny. We can probably assume that its writers, directors, and distributors have heard all the jokes about the title, so we will skip straight past those, assume they've been made, take them as read. It's a road trip movie.
It is, and it's in English. So, okay. You know, they have got subtitles, but, you know, it's kind of weird to have people speaking English and reading English subtitles. In fact, I've come here straight from watching it, so I'm fresh off the Finding Fanny boat.
As it
ominous
were.
As that sounds.
and what did you make of it?
Well, you know what? It was very quirky and it was very whimsical. And I actually loved it.
Two of my least favourite adjectives. When I hear the words quirky and whimsical, I reach for my pitchfork.
Right. Okay.
So well, sell it to me.
Sell it to you. Well, it's a low-budget film. It has one of India's most beautiful women in it, okay. Deepika Padukone, in a part that you've not seen her play before because she's always had these measured, very masala roles where she has to kind of dance and sing. And in this case, it's much more of her acting. And you're actually seeing her as a true actress, I would say. And the ensemble cast, this is where I think you would love it, because it has Nazirudin Shah, who is a theatre actor, and he's absolutely excellent in pretty much anything he does. And it's got Pankaj Kapoor in it. Again, they're not necessarily big names because they're not mentioned as the A-list, but in terms of acting, these are the guys to look out for. And Dimple Kapadia is a yesteryear actress who is absolutely, she was really gorgeous back then, and she still is. And, you know, she plays this kind of, this woman who's a widow of a man who worked on a ship, and and kind of ditched her. And she's lived alone for all these years. She's really uptight, you know. And Deepika Padukone's character, she's the widow of Dimple Kapadia's son, who died on his wedding eating cake. So it's quite whimsical. Sorry, it's very different for Indian cinema.
I'm making notes over here at this point. I'm getting a bit bewildered. We have a clip of Finding Fanny. It goes a bit like this.
Love never dies. It's always there, somewhere. And sometimes you just have to find it. The first time I was kissed was on my wedding day, 15 minutes before my husband choked and died. I'm a virgin.
The first time she was kissed was on her wedding day, 15 minutes before her husband died. That sounds like the start of a country song. I actually kind of mean that as a compliment. It's being pitched as a sort of, you know, low budget art house film. It has had fantastic reviews,
yes,
lots of awards, etc. Despite it being quirky and whimsical, would you recommend seeing it?
I totally would, because I went with a very eclectic group of people today. I managed to get a lady from Scotland, a girl from Wales, a couple of reviewers. We all went and saw it, and everybody came out with a smile on their faces. They loved the locales. I mean, Goa is obviously beautiful, and they picked some of the best looking parts of Goa to show to us. The acting, and Arjun Kapoor, again, he's done a lot of these masala, you know, roles in Bollywood, and then suddenly he does this role, which he's really taken to, and I actually was very impressed with his performance.
Okay, well, we'll move along now to a more straightforward film. This is a biopic of sorts of Mary Combe, and it's called Mary Combe. First of all, explain to listeners who may be unaware who Mary Combe is, was, etc.
Right, so Mary Combe is very much She's very, very much out there and coming back to boxing. She's an Olympic bronze winner. She won in 2012. And she was a woman from Manipur in India, part of India that, you know, they always felt was kind of left behind. And, you know, she actually came out as a woman who defied all odds. You know, her dad didn't want her to do boxing. It's not uncommon in Asian culture to say, my daughter shouldn't be boxing. You know, she's going to get punched in the face. She should be married off, sort of thing.
I'm not even sure how often it comes up as a consideration in Asian culture. Rarely, I would think.
Well, you know, you'd be surprised. People who want to go into the arts, into sports, are normally dissuaded by parents with things like, I don't want you to have a black eye, you know, because you should be getting married.
I'm not even sure this is necessarily an Asian cultural thing. If a daughter of mine came home and announced she sought a living as a professional pugilist, I think I'd be somewhat difficult to persuade myself.
Okay, fair enough.
We do have a clip from Mary Combe.
बॉक्सिंग ग्लव्स पहन के मोहम्मद अली
चल अरे तू पागल हो गया मेरे को
पर मैं बहुत अच्छा बॉक्सर कुछ सर बोलता है मैं बिल्कुल नेचुरल बॉक्सर है पर मैं जीत भी रहा
हूं मैं अब क्या या बॉक्सिंग
Bollywood has not been known for sports films, although I'm still assuming there's some vast epic musical based on the career of Sachin Tendulkar in the works. It would be a crime if there isn't. How has it taken to the Mary Combe story? Is the film a success?
It actually is a success. It's done extremely well in India, actually. It took something like 30 crores in its opening weekend, which is a big number for India. And again, you know, you have films like Bagh Milka Bagh, which came out last year. It had Farhan Akhtar in it, and that was about a male, you know, he was a these are normally male centric films when you see sporting films coming out of India, and as you say, they are rare. So to have one focused on a woman and a woman's journey, the fact that this is a woman who decided to, you know, get married, to have children, and then get back to boxing. So she had a husband. For me, what stood out was the fact that it's one of the first times in many, many years that I've seen a husband's character being portrayed positively, where this guy is supporting his wife. She has twins, and he says, look, I will look after these kids. I will work around your schedule. You go back to training, go back to being a boxer. And this is a real life story, because then she after the 2012 Olympics, you know, she had a child, and she's going to get back to boxing once she's trained up again. So it's quite an amazing story, actually. And it has Priyanka Chopra, who's like one of the biggest A-listers out there at the moment. You know, she's a singer, she's the face of Guess, you know. She's pretty amazing, and she's actually taken on this role really well. The only thing I would say is many people would say this feels like we're watching Priyanka Chopra on screen as opposed to a real life boxer, but I would say that she's taken and adapted to that role very well, and I don't know who else could have done it better.
Okay, we have to look finally and extremely briefly, like in about 20 seconds, okay. Dead at Haider.
Right, so that is the Hamlet of India. It's completing the trilogy by Vishal Bharadwaj. It's all about this man who loves Shakespeare, who's decided to make films like Omkara, which is Othello, Makbul, which was Macbeth, and now Haider, coming out on October 2nd from UTV Disney. With a really great cast, Shahid Kapoor, who is Haider, Tabu as Gertrude, and you have the Life of Pi star Irfan Khan as King Hamlet.
And just finally, in sort of maybe three words, worth seeing?
I would say it's worth seeing. It's one of those films that people have been waiting for. And again, we're not shown these at press screenings. So I can only say that I'll come back and speak to you after.
Please,
I've seen
do.
It.
That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. Ashanti Omkar, thank you very much, as well as my thanks earlier to our special guests, James Boyes and Raffaello Pantucci. Today's show was produced by Alice Block, researched by David Pleasant and Rebecca Unger. Our studio manager was Bill Luty. After the headlines is the menu. They'll be hearing from top chefs Bill Granger and Ollie Dabouz. Will explore a cat cafe spat in Montreal. You don't hear that on any other radio stations. And the Gelato World Championships. At 2200, I'll be back with Nancy Durham for the Monocle Daily. Midori House returns at 1800 on Monday. But for this edition, it's goodbye and thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life. A benchmark for style.